This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Humans reached a perilous period. There is no vacation from it. This summer, my campground, my runaway spot, hovered on the edge of the big fires again. From the thousands of refugees from the cities, dozens arrived with their trailers, their escape vehicles, with photo albums and grandmother's jewelry. The pines are dead, you see. Every summer now is burning season. At least it's better than California, where it's fire season all year round. And this was the year the Nile virus finally finished its journey across the continent, arriving from the east. A deadly virus from Africa, now in Canadian mosquitoes, in the north. They came to the dry desert country, where mosquitoes were never so thick as this year. So did the wasps in record numbers, but no bees, in a land of hungry flowers, the home of sweet fruit. Still, the hot sun fed me something to bring back to you. The inner fire that has only recently threatened to burn out. We'll talk about the big crisis. We get a report on climate camps and climate politics direct from Britain as I chat with Phil England, host of the 300-350 show on Resonance FM, London. From time to time all through this broadcast, you'll hear clips from the 350 man himself, Bill McKibben. As a reward, if you stomach all the poison, we will finish with a unique interview, I promise. Millions know about Joe Bagent for his class warfare book, Deer Hunting with Jesus. Now he's finishing a new work while posting his social barbs in his blog. I read everything he writes there, often laughing out loud, sometimes disapproving, generally understanding. You are in for a disturbing treat when we visit Joe Bagent. Here is Bill McKibben.
When the Arctic melted, it became pretty clear that it wasn't very far in the future. In fact, that it was somewhat in the past, that we were already past whatever that red line was. And indeed, Hansen's team said that the magic number was 350 parts per million. As they said in the abstract of that peer-reviewed scientific paper, any value for carbon in the atmosphere greater than that is not compatible with the planet upon which civilization developed or to which life on Earth is adapted. Pretty strong language. Right. And a pretty tough number, because we're already past it. We're at 387 parts per million and rising about 2 parts per million per year.
It is relevant to point out of this climate crisis that it comes coupled with the slow collapse of the former world financial system. Our way of living is broken. The planet has much less to give after we took so much. I know the headlines say we are past the big trouble. In fact, those headline writers must be contortionists to twist such bad news into good. Employment falls less than expected as recovery develops. The word recovery is always in there. Sure, 500,000 more go home this month if they still have one. The newest scam? Companies who buy out life insurance policies from those people so desperate or so sick they want to sell. The company continues the premiums, patiently waiting for each death to arrange the big payout. Thousands of such bets are turned into securities and sold to faceless investors, perhaps your own municipality. Investor companies plan to drag the full payments out of insurance companies. Capitalists are beginning to devour themselves. Well, they might. Not only is gold the fear metal up in value, ominously, Hong Kong has demanded its gold back. London has been the repository for international gold investment and trade since their days of empire. Now Hong Kong has its own safe house. Asia is cashing in its chips. Is the gold really still there? Even Germany is repatriating its gold, its signs of the last stand, as trust continues to evaporate. The stock market is too obviously fraudulent. During the summer, up to 80% of the trades were ultra-rapid machine-driven orders. As the trades churn, brokers make fractions of pennies that add up to more billions sucked out of the system. The biggest risers were obviously bankrupt firms like AIG and Citi. The London Times headline says even the bears are pulling out, delivering the shares they bet would go to nothing. The Federal Reserve lists over 400 banks in trouble. Every Friday brings another five down, more billions in losses. Fools above the insured limit, well, they lose it. But the bad loans, especially all those construction and commercial real estate clunkers, end up 80% or even 95% guaranteed by a layered pathway that leads straight to the taxpayers. All to be paid by the citizens of the future, or perhaps by foreign investors in some coming meltdown, or by unstoppable inflation.
Once upon a time, driving was a treat. A Sunday picnic trip, a personal retreat. Now we get into our cars to drive across the street. We're running out of gas, and we all feel the heat. Get off, get off, get off. Get off your ass and walk. Don't wait around while politicians talk. Save yourself some money, get to know your block. Get off, get off, get off. Get off your ass and walk.
The troops stay abroad because there is no work for them here. The wars of Bush and Cheney go on and on. The United States is by far the world's largest arms dealer. It's the only remaining industry, and even some of those parts come from China. Eventually, maybe sooner or later, Japan, Korea, and Germany must decide if they want to pay for American military bases. Just as West Germany helped the crumbling Soviets make payroll when they were unadmitted bankruptees. For the falling middle class, it is heartbreaking. Sent home. Now you have no value, few prospects. I've read and listened to so many stories. Almost everyone over 48 is likely retired now. They just don't know it. Six people apply for every job after 600 more gave up. It's closing time. And again, that personal pain of the suddenly useless, the broken consumer with the backdrop of failing governments at every level, we face the price of addiction. We come down from the high of V8 power, of just driving around for the hell of it, air tourism, techno junk, and media porn, to the many symptoms of withdrawal. And among those haunting ghosts, the birds that don't return. Seasons upended. Mistimed crops. Rising signs of a damaged atmosphere on a sensitive planet with a record of harsh rearrangements. That is our situation. The climate clock is ticking like a bomb. You and I, however few we are, have within us whatever key there is. We act or fail to act, not just for the coming generations, but for the ark, the boatload of species we came in with. We've become damaged gods. In her new novel, The Year of the Flood, Margaret Atwood takes us to the year 25 after the big cull, the disaster that almost cleared away humanity. There the green religionists, God's gardeners, still struggle with the owners, the ever-living corporations. Atwood writes, "We are using up the earth. It's almost gone. You can't live with such fears and keep on whistling. The waiting builds up in you like a tide. You start wanting it to be done with. You find yourself saying to the sky, 'Just do it. Do your worst. Get it over with.'" She could feel the coming tremor of it, running through her spine, asleep or awake, it never went away. Humans reached a perilous period. There is no vacation from it. This summer, my campground, my runaway spot. Over on the earth. Well, I feel better now, don't you? We will get to some positive actions you can do. Followed by the wit of Joe Bagent. I'm Alex Smith. You just heard a bit of music from Gene Burnett, who wants you to get off your butt and do something, certainly a theme of this show. And we ran a quick quote from Bill McKibben. That's taken from a speech that is rocketing around the world. It was recorded in Dunedin, New Zealand, on April 30th, 2009, just as McKibben was kicking off the 350 campaign, setting a new goal for our atmosphere. Veteran Pacifica radio host C.S. Soong produced a great edit of that speech, broadcast on KPFA in California on September 1, 2009. Download that whole MP3 program, and you should, from againstthegrain.org. Here is a couple of minutes from that speech where McKibben explains why we need mass activism. Then we're off to London to get the latest on climate camps.
And it sort of forced me to realize that that writing and speaking weren't enough. I'd been heard, you know, The End of Nature, which was the first book about global warming for a general audience, was in 24 languages and on bestseller lists all over the place and made into documentaries and things. That was 20 years ago in 1989. And I'd spoken and written in all the best, but really nothing was happening. Nothing on any scale large enough to even begin to slow down the pace of this destruction. So I began, as many others have begun, to try to think about how we might not just write and speak, but actually do something on a scale large enough perhaps to matter against the tide of this greatest problem that humans have ever faced. We got to begin with the science, and that is a way of saying we've got to begin by understanding just how deep in trouble we are at the moment. Far deeper than we realized 20 years ago, far deeper than we realized even 5 years ago. I know you all know about global warming and understand that it's a real and serious phenomenon. You may not know that in the last year or two, last 18 months really, the scientists at the cutting edge of this work have re-evaluated the degree of danger that we face and the pace with which that danger is coming at us. And the thing that first got them going on that reevaluation was the very rapid melt of Arctic sea ice in the summer of 2007. It happened long before the computer models had predicted. We'd clearly crossed a kind of threshold. We'd underestimated how fast things were going to happen. And not only was it confirmation that the planet was warming very fast, the sudden disappearance of this ice that had been there for long before human history, it was also a reminder that once these things start happening, they take on a hideous life of their own. You remove that white ice from the top of the world, and instead of reflecting 80% of the incoming solar rays, you now have blue water that can absorb 80% of that as it comes in. When that ice tries to refreeze in the winter, in the Arctic winter, it releases an enormous amount of heat in the process, and that heat translates directly down into the permafrost, into the tundra of Siberia and northern Canada and Alaska. And as that permafrost melts, it begins to release lots and lots of methane trapped beneath it into the atmosphere. Methane is another potent warming gas, just like the carbon dioxide that we emit. But in this case, the scary thing is that we're not emitting it. We're creating the conditions for it to be emitted. We've put enough carbon into the atmosphere to warm things to get this cycle started. But it's beginning to get beyond our control. Okay? They're beginning to take on a life of their own.
That was Bill McKibben. We'll try to squeeze in a little bit more later. Now, London calling.
London calling.
London calling through the faraway towns. Now war is declared and battle come down. London calling to the underworld. Come out of the cupboard, you boys and girls. London calling, now don't look to us. Phony Beatlemania has bitten the dust. London calling, see we ain't got no swing except for the rain and the crunch of thing. The ice is coming, the sun's zooming in. Meltdown expected, the wheat is going in. Engines stop running, but I have no fear, cause London is drowning. I live by the river to the imitation zone. Forget it, brother. You can go it alone. London calling to the zombies of death. Quit holding out and
While North Americans suck contentedly at the gas pumps, there's been a lot of climate action in Europe. To find out about this summer's climate camps and the run-up to December's Copenhagen Climate Conference, we are joined by Phil England, host of the 300-350 show on Resonance FM in London. Welcome, Phil.
Hi there. Hi, Alex. How are you doing?
Oh, it's so good to speak to you. I first want to ask you, can you tell us what a climate camp is?
Okay. I think it's, there's four main elements to it. One is education, one is movement building, one is sustainable living, and what's the fourth element? Direct action against the root causes of climate change. I mean, basically, this has been happening for about 4 years now in the UK, where people pitch up with their tents and camp out generally near the site of a large coal-fired power station or a planned site of an airport expansion, and get together and live sustainably for about a week. So basically they set up quite an incredible infrastructure of compost toilets, renewable energy systems, and kind of vegan cooking, which they kind of put together very quickly over a couple of days. So there's a complete infrastructure for low impact living. And then there's an amazing workshop program. This year's Climate Camp in London, there was about 8 different workshops going on at the same time and about 4 workshop slots during a day. And this was happening over the course of about 5 days. So it was probably a couple of hundred workshops. Quite an amazing feat to realize all this, really. And on top of that, training in direct action, because basically the idea is that action on climate change really isn't matching up to the scale that the science is telling us, the kind of level of urgency that we need and rapidity of government action. It's just not happening. So this is a kind of just a kick up the butt, really, for the politicians, but also trying to figure out how to live sustainably and work together to actually bring some of these changes about directly ourselves as well.
And people can find out what they can do legally, what their rights are, and you end up with some crazy actions. I read that somebody glued themselves to the floor, for example, that kind of thing. Anyway, I wanted to mention that the folks at Climate Camp set up their own radio station, calling it Dissident Island Radio. You can Google for that or find it on radioforall.net. Now, Phil, one story from those hours of useful on-site programs really hit me. The UK's only factory producing big wind turbines has been shut down and the rotor blades shipped offshore. So, I mean, you've got the British government, like everybody else, blabbering about green jobs. What happened there?
Yeah, this was an amazing contradiction that came to light on the kind of front pages shortly after the UK had done some more of its grandstanding about its low-carbon transition strategy. Its national plan. Yeah, one of the biggest, well, the biggest wind turbine factory said it was going to shift its operations to Texas, I think, or certainly somewhere in the United States where there was a lot more demand. Basically, what's holding up a lot of wind developments in the UK is planning applications, the planning system. A lot of people object to having wind power developments in their kind of neighborhood. So it's the local planning system which is kind of clogged up currently with a lot of objections.
Yes, you can have a filling station and we can all gasp in the poisoned air, but heaven forbid we should have a wind tower slowly rotating along the hill. Well, I'm also wondering, you know, many of us here in North America look to Britain and Europe as more progressive on climate, and yet I'm reading that the UK government sometimes uses anti-terrorism methods against these camps and forced One Green Festival into bankruptcy this summer. Is that why the location of the camps aren't announced ahead of time?
Yeah, absolutely. The feeling is that these camps just wouldn't happen if the location was revealed before time. So that's the one area of openness that is kind of restricted between when there's kind of the talks between the police and the activists take place before the camp. That's the one thing that isn't given away. But the funny thing about this year's camp was that after so much public criticism and various inquiries that happened into recent policing of events, the policing was pretty much non-existent. which was remarkable because it just turned the camps into a place from being quite stressful to being much more like a kind of holiday atmosphere. And it proved on the one hand that these camps are very able to police themselves in a sense. They have very good policies and processes for sorting out any disagreements that might arise. And the site has now been returned to a much better state than any festival would have. A lot of waste. This site is now completely returned to its original state, essentially.
So a bunch of humans can get together without leaving trash all over the place. You know, I try and stay in touch with activism here, but I didn't know there were climate camps organized in the United States and Canada. I didn't read anything about them in the newspaper. Funny that. But can you tell us what you've heard about other climate camps around the world?
Yeah, I think there's around 15 now across the globe this summer. And in fact, some of them are kind of later in the year, in the kind of lead up to the Copenhagen talks, the United Nations climate talks at the end of the year. There's three in Australia, one in New Zealand. There's a whole bunch across Europe. There was four in the UK and Ireland. And yeah, I think they're even, I won't say even, because I think last year there were some climate convergences, I think they're called, in the US. I think there was three last year, and I think there's at least two this year. One in Pittsburgh and one in Richmond, California. Coming up later in September, so I think if you Google climate convergence, they'll come up. Yeah, I think you alerted me to the direct action training that's happening across Canada that Greenpeace is starting to organise, particularly to raise the issue of tar sands.
Yes, if you go to greenpeace.ca, you can get the details on that. Well, I would like to move on to the international negotiations for a new climate treaty to be held in December in Copenhagen. And, you know, I know some of my listeners are starting to yawn, and myself, I'd sort of despaired about these. But I think that was a mistake. I've just heard a speech from Bill McKibben, who started up that website, 350.org. And listening to Bill, I realized we can't give up. This may be our best chance, maybe our only chance, to steer away from this climate precipice. So can you tell us, why should the average listener care about what's happening in Copenhagen?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really important opportunity. I mean, it's a long way from happening. You know, what we need is a scientifically robust and fair deal. And because we've left it so late in the day, the level of action that is required now is very dramatic. We have a very small carbon budget really left to play with over the next few decades. So we need a very strong agreement. And yeah, I mean, if we all have a framework as countries throughout the world, if we're all working together towards the same aim, if we know that everyone's working to solve this problem out, and really that's the only way that it's, that we're going to make this thing happen and achieve some kind of degree of climate stability, then yeah, an international agreement is our kind of best shot, really. But there's a lot of obstacles, there's a lot of ground to cover, really, over the next few months. And really, the ball is in the rich world's court. That's North America, Europe, Australia, you know, Japan. Really have to pull their fingers out and start taking this issue seriously, making big cuts, and also putting real finance on the table to both enable low carbon development in poor countries, but also to recognize that we have a carbon debt, really. We've caused the vast bulk of the climate change that has happened and is going to happen over the next few decades is kind of built into the system. And, you know, the countries feel the worst impacts of that shouldn't be left to fend for themselves. We have a duty to kind of help them adapt to some of the impacts that are inevitable. So we need to put a lot of money on the table to make this deal fair and scientifically sound.
Is there an organization of developing states or NGOs about this, and what are they asking for?
Well, the biggest grouping historically has been the Climate Action Network. But I think a lot of people now feel that they have kind of are probably too weak to support. Maybe they're changing, but historically they supported all the flexible mechanisms that made the Kyoto Protocol such a weak agreement. So people like Friends of the Earth International, which is about 70 national organizations right across the world and working in quite a democratic way, they've pulled out of the Climate Action Network and have joined a group called Climate Justice Now, which is a very big grouping of civil society organizations right across the globe, particularly from the poor majority world. And they're kind of challenging, really, the Climate Action Network to go for something much more radical. So they're putting justice at the heart of what they're asking for. And that's that movement is taking off in quite a big way.
Well, you know what's going to be said. Sure, we may have wrecked the world, but we're too broke to pay for it now. We just gave all our money to the bankers. So, you know, the public's not going to be in a mood, I would judge, to support paying for the pollution that we've caused. It's going to be a real tough problem to get by.
Yeah, I think national leaders need to start making the case to their populations. And there's a big call for heads of state to come along to the climate talks in December to make sure that, you know, significant action can take place, that it's not just down to environment ministers. Finance ministers should also be there. Heads of state should be there as well. But really, yeah, with the banking bailout, we showed what could be done, what kinds of levels of finance could be raised at short notice if it was felt there was an emergency. And of course, the climate emergency is so much bigger than the economic crash. Basically, if we don't have an environment, we can't have an economy. The economy is a subset of the environment and not the other way around. We all depend on the environment for our survival. So that's the one thing that it really is too big to fail.
Absolutely. I got to agree with you. You know, aside from Bill McKibben, another inspiration for me lately to get involved with these negotiations rather than just bitching about them has been George Monbiot, the author and columnist in Britain's Guardian newspaper. His column for August 31st says we have to act quickly on greenhouse gases or it will simply be too late. The science is in, but I still hear politicians sort of like dinosaurs promising to start cutting emissions back maybe in 2025 or 2050 after you and I may well be dead. Well, are some of the real targets emerging in time before Copenhagen?
Well, yeah, there are country groups within the United Nations talks that are putting quite scientifically credible targets on the table. You have the Association of Small Island States, and you also have the Least Developed Countries. These two country blocks between them comprise about well over 80 countries, and there's 192 countries sat around the table at the UN. So really, they are representing quite a body of people there, and they're suggesting, well, they've backed the 350 parts per million CO2 equivalent target that Bill McKibben is campaigning for, based on the James Hansen science, so that's all good, solid stuff. But they're also saying that global temperature increase should be limited to 1.5 degrees centigrade, which is a much more demanding and safer target than what the Obama-led Major Economists Forum recently agreed to, which was the 2 degrees C target, which is now 16 years old. Europe came up with that target 16 years ago based on what is now very old science, and we understand now that serious impacts are going to take place at much lower temperature thresholds. So 1.5 degrees C is a much safer target to go for. So, yeah, these are the countries that we have to listen to if we're going to get a kind of scientifically credible deal. And it's worth bearing in mind that the Major Economies Forum that Obama convened and was grandstanding about this 2 degrees C target, they only represent 39 countries. One other interesting thing that happened recently was that the European Environment Commissioner recognized that 2 degrees C was no longer safe, so it'll be interesting to see if there's any movement within Europe to acknowledge at a policy level that they can no longer stick to this outdated 2 degrees C target, and maybe we'll see a whole shift towards the 1.5 degrees C and 3 parts per million targets now.
Well, it's going to be tough, but it's got to be done. Now, here on the west coast of North America, basically we're dodging the fires and the smoke. And down in Australia, they're having one of the hottest winters they've ever had. They're getting 35 degree, 38 degree sea temperatures in the winter. And, you know, those are just parts of a broad current of things that are happening around the world. We're talking with Phil England. He hosts the 300-350 show in the UK, and note he renamed his climate radio program to that Carbon Target. I recommend listening to Phil's back shows found at climateradio.org, and you can get every new program by podcast. Is there anything you'd like to tell us as we wrap up, Phil?
Well, one other thing you should drop into your closing announcements is the web address for beyondtalk.net, which is, I think, an initiative of the Yes Men and Greenpeace, these kind of pranksters that expose corporate lies. They are encouraging people to sign up and commit themselves to direct action in the lead up to Copenhagen, to right across the US essentially, but also I think across the globe, to really make the shift that we kind of need to see before Copenhagen. So,
and I'm sorry, I missed the name. It's Beyond what?
Beyondtalk.net.
Ah, beyondtalk.net. All right, we'll tune into that. And also remember, folks, climateradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us, Phil, and I hope we can have these conversations from time to time.
Okay, yeah, sure. That would be good.
All right, I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Here is another quick announcement from Bill McKibben, followed by, as promised, our feature interview with Joe Bagent.
The strategy for that is to take that most important number in the world, 350, and make it over the course of a day one of the most well-known numbers on Earth. On the 24th of October next, we will be having a huge global day of action all around the planet. Climbers high up in the Himalayas, you know, 350 scuba divers on the Great Barrier Reef.
With the demise of first mercantile capitalism, and now with industrial capitalism on its ropes everywhere, after having wasted most of the world's vital resources, you'd think the whole stinking drama of greed and mass exploitation would necessarily draw to a close. You'd think there'd be nothing left to huckster. And after having pissed in most of the world's clean drinking water, gutted its forests and its jungles, leveled its mountains for coal and minerals, turned the atmosphere into a blanket of simmering toxins, well, you'd think it was time for the bastards to fold the game and go home with their winnings. No such luck.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Don't we all need a laugh in desperate times? When everything's falling apart, writer Joe Bagent brings it together. His blog is stuffed with tart tirades about the bastards, the rednecks, and the whole cast of our current planetary drama. It's titled after his most famous book, Deer Hunting with Jesus.
The one certainty is that the future will be an entirely different thing than has ever existed. Why? Because the global ecological collapse underway, and now irreversible, is going to change everything, period, for everybody. Nothing like it's ever happened in the past, so the past is completely irrelevant as a basis for assessment. Reading about the collapse of the Mayas won't help much. We ain't Mayas, and there are 6 billion of us munching away and shitting in the same global outhouse now.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Let's meet Joe Bagent. Hello there.
Hello there.
You know, I can't possibly describe you, Joe. I thought of different things, but would you care to offer our listeners your own thumbnail portrait of yourself? Who are you?
Oh, goodness. Curveball right out of the gate.
You bet.
Well, I don't know. Appalachian redneck born, ex-hippie. Turned into a journalist, traveled around the world, came back to always trying to understand America. I think that's one thing that's been consistent. Probably because I was raised extremely poor in a lower class, and so was always trying to understand why the America I saw every day wasn't the one that was being advertised, and that's sort of what I've written about for almost 30 years.
Well, lately you've written about the millions of people newly freed from the corporate machine. They have lots of holiday time now that they don't have a job. But you seem doubtful that these dispossessed Americans will protest. What will they do with their time when they're broke?
I don't think they can see, you know, what their condition really is. I don't think anybody's really sure the country's broke. They just sort of feel like as individuals they are. They don't understand. But right now we've got millions upon millions that nobody sees. Nobody sees, you know, that are having a very hard time of it. And what will they do? I think that we are becoming a second world nation, so I assume that what will happen is they'll get accustomed to living in a second world nation.
I wonder about the people who've been in a nice suburban house with their kids. They're headed towards a trailer or an RV or maybe a homeless shelter even. They don't have a computer. They may not be part of this conversation we're having now. Maybe it could be a bit liberating to get out of the yoke of the net that encompasses us all.
Well, what's interesting is that if you look, you know, at what health care, we're number 37, our quality of life, quality of so many things is gone. And even in many respects, you know, we already are a second world nation. I mean, my Lord, you know, 75% of the gross national product will be for debt in a few years. And people don't really believe it because they look around and we still have that thin, clear, commercial plastic skin over everything. The infrastructure is still stuck together. The houses still have their new plastic siding. And so this illusion, this consumer reality, you know, says, oh, no, we're not in that bad a shape. Just look, cars are shiny, and so on. But it's a hollow economy, of course, you know, the percentage of people that live on less than a dollar a day during the last 18 years has dropped by 44% because all the jobs are there now, not here. But the people living in a hollow economy don't know that. All they know is, I get up every morning, the coffee maker starts, I've still got wireless, everything must be all right. But really, it's a zombie economy.
A zombie economy. Well, there have been the poor in America for a long time. It shocked me as a Canadian. I went down to a Florida RV park, and there's a 40-foot bus with all the options, and right beside it, a 10-foot trailer. And in the trailer is an 8-year-old girl who can't eat a carrot because her teeth are so bad, and they're moving every 2 weeks. They get kicked out every 2 weeks to go to another. So she's not going to school or anything. So is this just more of the same, or is America in for a new shock about how it's become?
Well, you know, America's always needed an underclass, and the bottom of an underclass is called damn poor, you know. And they don't see it. People don't travel in the circles where you see it. We all run our little causeways to and from the job and the mall or whatever our life is made of, the university. But we've always had a lot of poor whites. I think that's the thing that nobody can quite grasp because the media, because culture and media is in urban centers, we naturally see, minorities and so on. But what we haven't seen is a permanent white underclass that's been here since World War II, at least. Well, if you want to count people in the Dust Bowl or the 4 million poor Southerners who needed liberation as much as the slaves did. They've always been around. They've always been the rough side down of the economy. And now there's more of them, you know, but they've always been around. We don't have to take the most dramatic homeless example. You go into the cheap cracker box modular homes, you know, with the box of ho-ho cakes, you know, on the crummy particle board table and the TV going. And this is the poverty of the mind, you know, the lack of education, the millions upon millions that can't read at any kind of a functional level, much less a credit card contract. They've always been here, and that number is growing. You know, I was raised in it, so I know, you know, we've always been here. And everywhere I go, I find us, whether it's Springfield, Oregon, or Rome, New York, or whatever. And we've always been here. Now it's coming back to bite the middle class in the ass.
I read another scary piece of yours, first published on Alternet, August 10th, titled, Corporations Are Now After Our Very Beings. What do you mean by that?
You mean about that was the one about consciousness, right?
Yes.
Well, you know, as our experience has become more digital, more removed from reality, more imagistic, more involvement, more time with screens, more time with the hyperbolic images and spectacle, people's expectations and understanding of the physical material earth becomes farther and farther removed. That's what I tried to talk about in the last chapter of the previous book. It's like a hologram, you know, and everything has to be more entertaining, more spectacular. For instance, we couldn't discuss health care. We couldn't sit down and say, okay, let's look at high blood pressure medicine, which I take. Let's look at these things. Instead, because of the need for spectacle in a nation of conditioned consumers looking for gratification higher and higher, it had to be about death panels, you know, because that's what titillates, that's what excites. And very quickly the discussion became, you know, reached that high level of hyperbole because the people are no longer capable of the attention span that it takes to conduct rational critical thinking. In fact, I'm not sure they have the tools.
Well, and we're lacking the memory. I mean, we don't remember that it was Ben Bernanke and the Fed who brought us into this mess, and now they're sort of giving him a pat, good job, Brownie, and putting him back in the chair. We don't remember even what he was saying then when he said there was no problem.
We don't even remember whole wars. Gulf War, Angola. I had somebody the other day that was 24 when it was when Angola was going on. That's an attorney. And he was 24 then. He said, oh, yeah, Angola. Didn't they have missiles or something? The national memory. I just did a chapter in the new book called The Sediment of Memory about a set of studies that were done that show that memory starts to decay, both personal and national, immediately when the event happens. And that Elizabeth Loftus was the famous researcher that proved it. And immediately, all outside factors, even if they're not trying to be suggestive, start to replace it, and a personal story is built or a national storyline is built, and the memory is eroded, and some things, they just disappear. And it's a very interesting phenomenon because it's kind of, from a national standpoint, rather new. And it's because we have so much media to make those suggestions.
And you suggest capitalism can rent us a prefigured consciousness, even a green consciousness, if you want, with labels telling the world just how green I am, you know. Maybe we could even buy an anti-corporate consciousness.
Well, they do every day. You know, capitalism is an amazing thing. It can co-opt anything. The first time I ever noticed that was in the 60s when the revolution became the Dodge Revolution. And that's what it does. If anybody's interested in it, they turn around and they sell it to you. I mean, you ever try to buy some hemp fiber clothing? Look at the cost, you know. I don't know. You know, no matter what people's desires are, the object of capitalism is to extract money from people, so they extract it on the basis of that desire. There is no such thing as buying green. You know, solar generators, wind, wonderful stuff, but think about what a solar panel takes out of the earth to make it, or the digital things that operate or regulate it. Think about what our laptop does or our cell phone. I mean, it starts and ends either in the soil or under the soil, and that's the thing that people are not able to do because they've been transfigured by digital media, by electronics, and so on. And so they live in a hologram, images of images of images of images, many, many times removed. What kind of a practical consciousness can you have when you operate that way?
You've also said the global ecological collapse underway is now irreversible, and that we've never seen anything like it. That brings up two questions for me. Why is it irreversible, and should we just give up and start drinking heavy?
Well, I haven't done that. But I have never met, you know, what we get for public consumption. Okay, you can go buy all the wonderful books about how we're going to fix it, but they're products, remember, and you're buying them because somebody is sating your desire for a profit. That speaker that's getting $5,000 or whatever, you know, Arianna Huffington or whatever, selling ads because some people are liberal, some people are conservatives. But I have yet to meet, you know, a person that is a professional scientist involved in that. I have yet to meet one that says it's reversible. I have scarcely met any that said it's arrestable. As long as we have 6 billion people, that'll be 12 billion people in very few years, it's not reversible, is it?
Well, we can't all go back to growing organic vegetables. There isn't enough room for that number of people to leave what seems to be a mechanized consciousness now. I wonder, have we evolved into a dependence on this corporate feeding tube, or is it devouring us?
Well, we can be dependent on it, and we are dependent on it. The global corporatized system dominates the needs hierarchy from top to bottom, at every level. Try to think of something. I mean, like I always say, the varnish on this floor, the clothes I wear, the guitar that's standing in the corner, the food in the refrigerator itself, the coffin I'll be buried in, all of these come from corporations. We can envision no other way for the world to become manifest. But given the number of people and the population, I don't know. I know some pretty heavy hitters that say, well, undoubtedly you're looking at a series of buybacks, you know, whether it's through warfare or starvation or disease, you know, a series of them, not just some huge cataclysmic thing that cuts it back to a billion or so, something that's a little more sustainable. But, you know, the other thing is, too, and I've been chatted for it, and I apologize, you know, when we say the world's overpopulated, therefore it's irreversible until, even if we disappeared tomorrow, it would never, Mother Nature doesn't care, it would just make something else happen. But I've been chatted for making it sound like too many people, that it's Africa and Latin America's fault. No. A 24-year-old man in America, single, uses more of the earth up than 16 farming families in India. You know, so I wanted to make that point, you know, that it is the sheer numbers, yes, but we have a responsibility, just personally. You know, we don't have to have, you know, oh, my God, if we all do everything right, then it's all going to be all right. Well, America is cupcake land. It's never going to be all right again. But we can do the right thing. You know, I'm, for the first time in my life, I'm eating organically and, you know, using very little of things these days because it makes me feel better. We do have a conscience. We do have a belief in justice and balance. And at least we can act on that as human beings.
We're talking with Joe Bajan, blogger and author of the best-selling book Deer Hunting with Jesus, A Disturbing Portrait of the American Underclass.
America is one big yard sale now as we close out the books on industrial capitalism, only to discover that all our neighbors were as broke as we were, that it was all on the plastic, the furniture, the wines, the digital toys, the camping gear we never used. There's something eerily sad in these tens of thousands of suburban Saturday morning sales. There are seldom any buyers, not even many free box takers, only sellers. An uncharacteristic silence hangs in the air, and there's a feeling of some unspoken recent disaster of immense proportion, some Chernobyl-like thing that left everything standing. Population growth is the rhino in the playpen, the root cause of our approaching eco-disaster that no one honestly talks about. On the left, we get an onslaught of information about what we must do and must not do to stop climate change. Good Democrats get Al Gore's advice, which somehow never mentions the corporations doing the damage. And all of America gets feel-good electric car ads. Buy your way out of the problem. Or at least your guilt, if you happen to have any. But nowhere do we get an honest discussion about population growth. You can argue that climate change may or may not destroy us, but uncontrolled population growth is guaranteed to do the job.
You've written in defense of rednecks while mocking urban liberals. Now that Georgia's drying out and Texas seems about to shrivel up, is there a backcountry recognition in do you sense it that the climate is screwed?
Backcountry, you mean?
Yeah, I mean outside of the liberals and the cities on their computers, are people who are right on the land, do you think they're getting it?
Well, they're kind of in the suburbs in the heartland now. I use the term rednecks. I embrace it. I am one, and it's the name of a culture, among other things. And I think that they're aware that something is terribly wrong. For instance, when we saw all those red-faced people screaming, went to one of those healthcare things recently, and three people were wearing guns. Of course, if you ask them, they would say, oh, it's my Second Amendment rights. But really, something much more ominous is going on. And the screaming and the hysteria and the unthought-out, irrational theatrics that we saw are the release of an incomprehension and an anger and anxiety going on. You know, somebody just propped them up there and pressed their button because they don't have a language to describe where their problems are really coming from. But, yeah, everybody feels it. Everybody's afraid. Nobody talks about it, you know. I mean, at the lowest level, yeah, it's fishing and hunting. At the middle level, it's, I think everybody in America senses that the ground has shifted under us, that nobody knows its name, you know. Well, we know its name, you know. It's the collapse of capitalism as we've known it, American-style capitalism.
And I wonder, how long do you think we'll wallow in these false promises of recovery before something really important cracks open? Do you think you and I will live to see the Great Correction?
No. You know, I don't think so. You know, there is no recovery in the sense, you know, yeah, the housing market's going to come back like it was. We're all going to be doing the same thing, you know, as we did before. Obviously, it proved unsustainable. Obviously, it proved to be a bubble that when it broke, shattered everything around it, you know. But given that people, this is the only consciousness they have. This is the only world they've known, the one that they were raised in a corporate state. Personally, I know he wouldn't get reelected, but I would much have preferred to see Obama stand up, name it the way it really is, and at least, I know a lot of urban liberals and super conservatives especially wouldn't buy it, or they wouldn't want to buy it, but we all know what the truth is. Common sense tells us what's sustainable. I would rather he be noble and right than in bed with the snakes he's with.
Could you tell us a bit about your new book?
Well, it's masquerades as a memoir, but it's really about the creation of a permanent white underclass in America after World War II. 45% of Americans lived on farms before World War II, but by 1960, only 6% did. But I found out from a guy at Johns Hopkins, and it just set me off, that it was a purposeful forced migration out of rural America into the cities to sustain the wartime economy. Corporations and large entities, and including, you know, FDR, did not want to see all the money that they had made during the war suddenly stop. The war boom was the answer to the Depression. DuPont wanted to keep on selling nylon that had used for Jeep tires and parachutes. And to do that, they had to, A, get more consumers, get them to working, get them a paycheck, get them off those basically subsistence farms. They weren't poor. They lived okay. They didn't have much money. And it was pretty much a forced migration, forced through economic devices. But I read the old stock reports, share reports for DuPont, and they said, we're going to have to move these people out of the country. Out of the countryside. We're going to have to get them to buy things they don't really want. We have to have the government's cooperation in making this new American lifestyle that consumes these things. And I about fell over when I read it because I know my family was part of that migration.
Good book on that, the DuPont Dynasty. Great big thick book, hard to find, but well worth reading. Well, as we wrap up, if I hand you an open mic, which my brain tells me could be a dangerous idea, is there anything else that you'd like to rant about?
No, I sound like I'm ranting because I'm trying to compress a lot of things in talking. But, you know, I do believe that hope is mystical thinking. Knowing the facts allows you to deal with things, you know. That's all. I mean, look at things for what they really are.
Good advice from Joe Bagent. His blog is titled, after his famous book, Deer Hunting with Jesus, Dispatches from America's Class War. You can find his latest essays at joebagent.com, spelled J-O-E, obviously, B-A-G-E-A-N-T.com, and look for his upcoming book. It's A Tonic for the Dimming Soul. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Thank you so much, Joe, for joining us.
Thank you.
I hereby announce that this government exists so as to preserve the earth, not so it can serve us longer, but so that we may serve the earth longer and better and with complete humility for the only mother we have ever had or ever will have. Let us now wage peace against every war-making entity on the planet. Tomorrow morning at 8 a.m., I will cancel the space program and its interstellar wastefulness, and reassign those resources to the hungriest people, not just here in America, but across the world. I herein declare the era of American materialism and prosperity officially closed for business, which I admit is no great accomplishment, given that it's already over and dead. And thus I order the hair and the nails to cease growing. Likewise, the American lifestyle is also canceled. All citizen debts are canceled, and banks as we know them are abolished. Money is abolished, to be replaced with a system of social credits based upon a planetary sustainability, meaningful and useful human productivity, and an economy of human labor and art. I ordered the elites who have held captive the people's medium of exchange, then rented it back to them, creating a nation of debt slaves, immediately to prison without any trials by the judicial commissariat who have always served their interests. Any true wealth that exists other than the gifts of nature, we alone have produced by our labors. Thus we have the right to redistribute it so as to serve the greatest number of people, not the elites. Consequently, there will be a redistribution of all genuine wealth, not fiat currency wealth, but true wealth, such as access to health care, access to education, access to clean air, and the right to the love of a fully paid stay-at-home mother. All nannies are hereby fired with full unemployment compensation to begin immediately. From now on, the national policy is pay as we go. We choose to live within the society and economy we actually produce and create, not one based upon borrowed billions from other nations, most of which was likewise extorted from the production of their citizens. Nor will we avail ourselves to the profit of empire through thuggish conquest of the indigenous desert peoples, jungle peoples, and savanna land peoples of the planet. And lastly, this nation's capital will be moved to Beckley, West Virginia, to mountaintop removal coal country, where every congressman and every senator will be required to work 10 hours a week as a mucker, separating rock from coal. Or if age and health prevent any congressman or senator from doing so, then they will work as a telemarketer. In either case, they shall enjoy the same wages, standard of air, water, and health care as citizens presently enjoy residing there. Food stamps and commodity cheese will be issued monthly. Now go out there and relax and enjoy life. Rediscover and redefine art and labor, meaningful work and play. To that end, I have declared marijuana legal. Thank you.
That's Joe Bagent's would-be presidential speech. And dang, we're out of time. Way back there, you heard The Clash saying in 1979, the meltdown is coming. Don't forget to download Bill McKibben's speech from AgainstTheGrain.org, the September 1st program. Go to 350.org to find out what's happening in your area on October 24th. When it comes to climate, let's get our politicians on track. Join in or start your own bright idea, but do something, damn it. I'm Alex Smith. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Every one of you is more connected to the world than the most connected person in the entire world was 20 years ago. We need you to go to the website, 350.org, spread the word.